And at this time, it gives me great pleasure to announce a really neat gal who's going to share her testimony tonight. She gave up going to a Super Bowl party to do this tonight. Lexi!
Give it up for Lexi! Notes at these things, but if you hit your head hard enough, you lose your memory. So I have to take notes. So, yeah.
Me too.
Thank you. Thank you. I know some people get fussy with it. All right. Lexi, alcoholic.
Hi, Lexi.
You're ahead of me, Billy. My sobriety date is May 11th, 2022, and today's actually my 21 months. And my home group is the happy hour here at 1600 Club. So I was born and raised in, it's a little suburb right outside of Denver, Colorado. I lived there for 22 years. I am the youngest of two. I have an older sister, and we were born to, young parents, who were still, you know, in their party phase and had literally zero patience for children. So when we were around them, you know, like I was a big crier. So like I learned to just not cry. Otherwise, repercussions would come after that. Just like a clip of how they were. It wasn't fun growing up in that household. Addiction runs on both sides of my family pretty heavily. My uncles gave me my first drink at 10 years old, and it was apple pie moonshine. And so at family parties after that, I would kind of watch everybody, and I knew like when they started getting drunk enough, I could just go around and like sip out of their drinks, and then I'd ask them for money and stuff, and it would work every time. And but I never felt a drunk. I never felt a drunk out of that. My parents also had like a lot of friends, their young friends living with us. And they would do a lot of drugs, majority drugs in the house, with us living there. And it's kind of crazy. They would be living with us 1 minute, and then I'd be at their overdose funeral another moment, you know. I saw a lot of that growing up through that. I saw a lot of deaths through addiction. On that note, almost every alcoholic and addict in my family is dead due to this disease, and I am the first and only family member to get clean and stay sober thus far. And I'm actually, this is the longest I've ever been sober. It's 21 months, so this is pretty cool. Most of my upbringing, I was in like a survival mode. I was constantly living in fear. I would get really bullied at school, and then I would come home and get abused. So it was just constantly like, how do I stay safe? And I really didn't know where I belonged, because for the majority of my childhood, I had lived with my grandparents. I was 8 years old by the time I started actually living with my parents, and it was like really scary. I didn't understand what was happening. I didn't really know my parents. So throughout my whole childhood and upbringing, I really just didn't feel like I belonged anywhere. So I guess like high school is when I started fitting in, and that was just with the stoner kids. You know, we'd go hang out at what we called the pit, ditch our classes and go smoke weed behind a trash can, and then go to like our next class. And that was just what I started doing, you know? And I realized that when I was smoking weed, it really slowed down my thoughts. And like for a brief moment, I didn't have to think about, oh my God, who's gonna torture me when I go back into this class, or which one of my parents is gonna be mad at me when I get home, you know? For a good moment, I just didn't have to think about any of that stuff. I got drunk for the first time at 18. I didn't go to any high school parties or anything. I had no friends. So I had my graduation party, and that's the first time I got drunk. And it was UV blue. Like, that was the thing then, was UV blue. And I drank that whole bottle to myself and just passed out, and everyone else enjoyed my party, you know. And I wasn't a fan of drinking at that time. I didn't really see the fun in it. So At 18, after I graduated, I moved in with my boyfriend at the time to get out of the abusive situation I was in at my parents' house. And he introduced me to the act of doing drugs. I had always been surrounded by drugs and alcohol, but he introduced me to the act of doing them. And that was like a ton of different things, you know. Whatever he brought, you know, I did. And cocaine was the one that stuck with me. And in between lines, you know, I noticed people were drinking. So I thought, okay, I'll just do that too. Because I didn't really like drinking, but everyone else was doing it. So I said, okay, you know, I'll do that too. So I don't stick out. And very quickly, I learned what a blackout was. My friends just kind of told me that I was a lightweight and I needed to build my tolerance. So through building my tolerance, I was drinking more frequently. It wasn't daily, but like we would drink more throughout the week and the weekend. And I would just drink more to, you know, build that tolerance. And then I was using more because it kept me out of a blackout longer. So they very both went downhill pretty quickly. I did start feeling though that like that same kind of break in my brain that I did from when I started smoking weed. I started as a very happy drunk, a fun drunk, you know. I wasn't the one that like cried or got angry. I had fun, you know. I left all my problems behind and just focused on the now, which was having fun. And you know that went on for a little while, but at 19, I left that relationship and I stopped drinking and stopped using, and I enrolled into medical school to be a surgeon. I was doing really good, going to school full time and working full time at a hospital. So I really didn't have time to get into any trouble. I had finished one semester. I was like going through the finals of it, and in that month, I had 5 family members die, and I absolutely lost my mind. One of them was my great-grandma, and she was my best friend in the entire world, and that just destroyed me, and I didn't know what to do. So I dropped out, and I got into another relationship with an addict, and that became my pattern. Was dating addicts. It allowed me an escape from my family, and like they weren't gonna tell me no to drinking and using. So it was just the enabling back and forth that I looked for. So I went back to that party lifestyle, and I just figured that was the only way to suppress those feelings, because up until this moment, you know, I wasn't allowed to feel things because my parents had no patience for it. So I wasn't allowed to feel things, and so I just kept, you know, I guess I moved into the adult thing of suppressing with alcohol and drugs. At 21, I started working at a club, and I was serving drinks, and my family called it the Devil's Den. And looking back on it, I think it's kind of funny, because they're so right. It's not funny. That place was insane. But at the time, I was like, no, it's not. And I had no idea the mass destruction that was going to come to me from that place. But I knew there I could make a lot of money and very quickly. And my alcohol and drug habit, like I said, was going downhill very quickly. And I needed to keep up on that habit. So I needed money. So the next 8 months working there was complete insanity. Absolute insanity. I started drinking and using daily. We were allowed to drink and use at work. It was just an open thing. Everyone knew, everyone did it. And it wasn't frowned upon. And I started to help the dealers in there push drugs. And they were like, you know, it wasn't like your homie next door who, you know, would give you drugs once in a while. Like, these were real dangerous people that I didn't understand at the time. It was like danger. So I started stealing from them, stealing from my drug dealers. That almost got me killed a few times. And I started stealing from my family. So I wasn't allowed in their homes. And so I was like slowly starting to lose everything around me, but it was like slow motion. I still didn't understand, like, these were all losses, these were bad things. I didn't understand that. It was, I think, just that survival mode still. And in that 8 months, I also endured like horrific things. I was drugged and sexually assaulted. I was jumped. Somebody attempted to kidnap me and attempted to kill me. And then I was homeless. I was sleeping in a park. My family at the time was like, we're moving to Santa Maria. None of us had ever been here. I don't even know how they picked this place, to be honest. But they were like, we're moving to Santa Maria. And I wasn't allowed because they said you have to be sober to move with us. You're not going to live in our homes unless you're sober. And so I thought, all right, fuck you guys. Sorry, I'm going to try not to cuss. So I thought, I don't have to worry about them hounding me about my drug and alcohol use, you know? I didn't have to worry about hiding things and, like, dodging their phone calls and making sure they don't have my location and stuff, you know? They were going to be thousands of miles away. You know, again, at this time, I didn't think I had a problem. I thought I just had bad luck. I thought I just, you know, I was at the wrong place at the wrong time. And I thought it was everyone else's problem. Everyone was out to get me. Within 2 weeks of them moving here, I had lost my relationship, my friends, my family. I was running from numerous drug dealers, and I was homeless in the middle of winter in Colorado. There's snow there, and I was sleeping on a park bench, you know? That was not fun. And so finally, you know, I just kind of felt like, I don't want to say defeated, because that wasn't my defeat, you know? But I told my family, you know, I want to move out there with you guys. I'll get sober. So I literally left my entire life there in a trash can, threw all my belongings away, got on a plane with one backpack, and came to Santa Maria. So again, I've never been here, and I didn't know anybody here when I first moved here. You can't outrun addiction. It follows you, like, everywhere. So within a few weeks of moving here, I had already found a dealer, and how I found it was really dumb. I used to go on dating sites and, like, just look through their pictures, and I said, that person looks like a drug dealer, and I would, you know, and I'd message them. That's how I found it, you know. I didn't know anybody here. I was desperate. I had to figure it out, and that's one thing. I always figure things out. I always find a way, good or bad. I always find a way. I had found a dealer. I became a binge drinker. So again, I stopped the daily drinking. That was the longest time I drank daily in my drinking career, was just that 8 months. And my full addiction was like 6 years. So I went back to just not drinking daily, but I would binge drink. I would drink like a normal people's week's worth of alcohol in like one night. Like, I just couldn't stop. There was not a limit for me. And in this binge drinking, I became violent. I would black out and get really violent. And then I got a DUI. And that was all within 2 months of me moving here altogether. Also in that time, that's when I started hearing from people like, I think you have a problem. I think you have a problem. No one ever said you should get help, so I never really like knew where help was, but they just kept telling me, you have a problem. Even my friends, like, they would be like, why do you act like that when we go out? You know, they wouldn't want to go out with me because I'd fight and then like puke in their cars and then fight them when they dropped me off, you know, and then the cops would come, and that's what it always ended up. And I didn't understand, you know, like, I'm just having fun. That's fun. I was sentenced to AA through the DUI. I had to do 45 meetings in 30 days, and that was because of, they tried to hand it to me pretty hard because of my blood alcohol level. It was 0.27, and I wrecked the car and set it on fire. So I had to do the AA meetings, the DUI classes. I had to pay for my parents' car because it wasn't my car. I wouldn't wreck my car. I'm going to wreck someone else's car. That's not my problem, right? So I wrecked my parents' car. I had to obviously pay for that and everything. And Nothing got through to me. I will say though, when I was sitting in a meeting one time, somebody explained the sign to me, and they said, "Do you know what that means?" And I said, "No." And they said, "Well, when you go to the liquor store for a beer, for one beer, do you come out with one beer or do you come out with a 12-pack?" I said, "Well, a 12-pack, because then you got to go back, you know, and get more." And he said, "That's not normal. You're an alcoholic." Okay, well, I thought I was just being smart, you know, thinking ahead. But it still just did not occur to me that I had a problem. So I did these meetings and just never looked back. I didn't want to hear or see this place ever again. So after that, I started dating another addict, right? I was going to keep going, and I'm going to stay with someone who's going to allow me to keep going. We went on a good run for a while until he actually went on a 5-day blackout binge, destroyed our house, destroyed our cars, just went insane. And I finally saw what everybody was watching me do. And it scared the shit out of me. I was embarrassed, I was scared, but you know, I wasn't gonna admit that I had a problem. I told him he needed to get help, right? And I was doing the same thing, but I didn't need to get help. He just needed to get help, right? But after, you know, it just kind of wore me down. After every issue we just kept having, you know, with our addictions, it just wore me down, and that was my limit. And I left, and I got sober. I say sober, but it was dry. I had no intention on coming to AA or NA. Neither one of those was in my plan. That I had erased it from my brain completely. That was not going to happen. So I became a dry drunk. And if anyone's been a dry drunk, you understand how absolutely miserable that feeling is. It's like they say, it's restless. You're restless, irritable, discontent. And I didn't understand why I was still feeling these things when I wasn't drinking or using anymore. I was doing what everyone told me to do, you know. But I was still, you know, feeling those things. I was still being horribly mean to everyone around me and myself. I wasn't pleasant to be around. My family, I think, kind of had the same wondering of like, well, she's not drinking anymore, so why is she still like this? And like I said, no other addicts in my family have gotten help. So we're all new to this at this point. We don't know what to do. And at 10 months dry, I got into a car accident and it almost killed me. And that is when I really just was done with life. On top of that restless irritability and discontent, I had become extremely depressed and lonely. I had to isolate because of my injuries. I was very angry at God. I wanted nothing to do with God. He was my worst enemy at that point. I had PTSD and I just had no will to live anymore, you know. It was really hard. And with all that being said, that is a perfect storm for a relapse, and that is exactly what happened. On May 9th, 2022, I was home alone. That's the scary part, being home alone. And I was feeling all those feelings. I was going into my fifth surgery. Oh no, I had just had my fifth surgery, and I was just over it. I didn't want to feel the way I felt, and I was home alone, and the neighbor knocked on the door. And I had literally only spoke to this neighbor one other time. And he goes, "Hey, do you want to come over? We're just listening to music. We got some beer, and we got some Coke. You want to come over?" And I thought, yup. No second thought. I'll be right over. Let me get my shoes on, you know? And I went over there, and that's exactly what I did. And I, you know, everything was fine until people started calling and asking where I was. And then, you know, I'm dumb when I'm drunk. I answer phones when I'm drunk. And I answer phones and I lie. So, like, first my boyfriend's calling me saying, "Where the hell are you?" Right? Like, "Where's dinner?" And I'm slurring my words. I'm like, "Oh, we're just driving around. I'll be home soon," you know? And then here goes my mom calls. "What are you doing?" And I'm slurring and, "Are you drunk?" And of course I say no and hang up real quick. And I just, you know, it's in those times, I don't know if I kind of like try to make a plan to get out of it, and then eventually I'm just like, whatever, dude, they already know. Like, let's just keep going. Like, it's not gonna get any worse. Let's just keep going. And it did get worse. I blacked out, per usual. I went home and I got violent with my boyfriend, and the neighbor called the cops, and that all happened. That wasn't like all night. That was an hour and a half of time, right? That's insane. I don't know what's wrong with me. That's insane. So my boyfriend kicked me out. He said, you can't live with me anymore. Fair enough. I had to go back to my parents. So all day on the 10th, I was still drunk. So my mom just said, you know, stay out of my face, go puke elsewhere, and we'll talk tomorrow. And the morning of the 11th, she said, you know, if you are going to live here, you need to go get help. And she said, you're going to go to rehab. And I said, no, they take your phones. Okay, I'm privileged. I'm not going to get my phone taken. I need Facebook and Snapchat. So I said, no, I'm not going to rehab. And I didn't know what sober living homes were. So that wasn't an option. And so we just kind of made like our own rehab. My parents said that they would test me if they felt they needed to test me. I needed to be home at a certain time. I needed to be in meetings every day, at least one meeting a day, and it was just our own thing that we put into place. So May 11th, I came and sat in this corner and cried with my mom, and that was my first day in AA. And you know, when I was here on my court card, I was such a brat. I used to, instead of saying I was an alcoholic, I would say, oh, I'm Lexi and I'm on a court card, because I thought it would piss you all off. You know, that was my goal, was to piss everyone off. I don't think it did, but in my brain it did. So this time, you know, I finally sat down and I said, you know, I'm an alcoholic. And the relief that I felt, because it was like, I never thought I had a problem. But I knew I was miserable, and I knew what I was doing was wrong. But where I don't know if I made a loophole for myself, but it was like, I don't have a problem with alcohol and drugs. I have a problem saying no to alcohol and drugs, right? Like, that was not the same thing. And I just rode that wave, you know, for a while. And so when I finally admitted it, it was kind of like, you know, something in me was eating me alive. Like, I needed to tell, I can't keep secrets for very long. I'm so bad at it. So I felt like I needed to tell my secret, and I was an alcoholic. So getting sober in your 20s is like leaving a house party at 9:30. that's been my biggest conflict. There's so much more fun out there. I know there's people having fun. You know, I know, I see it on my Snapchat, my social media. I see all my friends out there having fun. And it's like, I can't. I'm not allowed back in that house party, because I'm going to punch someone. And I'm going to, like, drive a car into a wall or something. And then I'm going to, like, ruin someone's car. Like, it's just not for me. But it's hard. It is hard. I'm not saying getting sober when you're older isn't hard. But, man, your 20s is for fun. And I'm just not good at fun, you know? Well, not society's version of fun, I guess, in your 20s. So, also, I was sitting in a room with, no offense, guys, old people. And they were just sitting there talking about, oh, my life is so great today. I don't worry about anything. I'm happy, joyous, and free. God is here. And I just thought, fuck you guys. I started building these resentments, because I just thought, well, you guys are just saying that because you guys got to party longer. You didn't get taken out of the house party at 9:30. You guys stayed till 2, 3, 4 in the morning, right? And so I was pissed off. Everyone got to have more fun than me, and so I hated everybody here. And I told myself, you know, I'm not doing those steps, because first of all, what does any of that mean? And second of all, I'm not getting a sponsor, because I don't need a babysitter, and no one's going to tell me what to do. And that was my promise that I made. Sitting in the back corner, I said, I'm not going to do those things, you know. I'm just going to sit back here, and I'm just going to do what I'm supposed to do so I can have a place to live. But I did want to stay sober. I will say that. I did want to stay sober. So about 30 days in, I just wasn't seeing this life everyone was talking about. Like, how did you guys get this life? And when did it start happening? Because it wasn't happening for me, and I was a month in, and that was long enough. Like, I needed to see results. And I wasn't, you know, I was stuck on that, instant gratification, okay? That instant gratification that comes with taking a drink, you get a buzz real quick, or you do whatever and you can get high real quick. You know, I was stuck on that, that things come when I want them. And that's just not how things happen. So I attempted suicide at 30 days sober. I didn't know what else to do, and I was exhausted. But what I had to learn or relearn is that you have to work for things in life, including sobriety. And some days are really fucking hard, and you don't want to. I'm just gonna cuss. I'm sorry. I had to learn that some days are just really, really hard, and some days are like easy to get through the day, you know. And some days you have to, you know, work harder than the other days. And that's not just for sobriety. That's literally for everything in life. And I had forgot those basic rules of life. I forgot how to be a functioning member of society. So out of absolutely, completely defeated, I started my steps, and I got a sponsor. And you know, I kind of held her hostage. I trapped her in a way to be my sponsor, because I'm like standing over here having a meltdown with another member, and they were like, you know, you should ask this person. And I turned around and I was like, will you please be my sponsor? And she was like, yes, like, you know. And so we started the steps, and she got me through them. I would work with her for like 6 hours a day at her house, and we just jammed them through, you know. I mean, I understood them, but we just, you know, we took time out of both of our days to just get me through those steps and get me going, you know, because I was losing it. So obviously we started with acceptance. I had to accept that I couldn't drink because I was an alcoholic, and I couldn't do drugs because I'm an addict. I had to accept that my life had become unmanageable. That I had to drop basically my entire group of friends and the old lifestyle that came with them. This one's still hard for me to accept, but I work on it actively, is that I cannot control people, places, or things. As bad as I want to, I cannot do it. That is not my place. And also, I had to accept that, you know, I've learned being here that not everybody gets the chance to get sober and stay sober. I've had 5 friends die in the last year from this addiction. And, you know, I kind of shared in a meeting the other day, the topic was your solution, what's your solution? And I shared, you know, because one of my friends just passed away on Monday. And I just was thinking, you know, oh, if I could just shake them right now, shake them, like, wake the fuck up. There is a solution, you know. And I was that stupid, you know? I was that stupid too in my addiction. So it's like, you know, it's a hard thing to accept, but it is what it is. I also had to completely give myself to the program. And that meant, you know, in all aspects, reading the book. See, I've been here less than 2 years and I had to duct tape it. I'm in this thing more than I ever wanted to be. I hate reading, but I'm in it a lot. Also, I couldn't work. I still can't work because of my accident. I'm still going through surgery. So I basically made AA my job. And I really got into it. I go to meetings every day. I started to get commitments. My first commitment was the chips, and I actually just gave that one up, and it stung a little bit because that was my first commitment, you know, that was my baby, and I gave it up. And then I had a secretary commitment, and then I do the H&I, so I go to the sober living homes and the jails and stuff like that, and then sponsoring. That's a big commitment. And it helps not only the people that need sponsored, but me as well. It keeps me on my toes, for sure. Sponsoring's hard. And I swore, too, after I did the same thing. I got a sponsor, and I worked the steps, and then I was doing that, and I was like, I'll never be a sponsor. I'll never sponsor anybody ever. And, you know, every time someone asks me, I'm like, yes, yes. But I do enjoy sponsoring. So in the book, it says those who do not recover are people who cannot completely give themselves to the simple program. For the new people, This program is simple. You come in here, I mean, to me that looked like Chinese, and I didn't want to understand it. And then there's all these things on the walls that are like motivational, and I don't want to hear it, right? And in my brain, I was like overthinking all this stuff and just blowing it up into like a problem. You know, this place isn't a problem, it's a solution. But that's if we choose to be willing, honest, and open-minded. And that's literally the key to this place. If you have any reservations about it, just come with willingness, honesty, and an open mind, and just keep listening. And something will click, something will click. I also had to be willing to change and to be uncomfortable. You have to get comfortable being uncomfortable here. And it's hard. But once you do it, like I kind of look for you know, situations to make me uncomfortable, like taking my own personal inventory or doing that. Oh wait, that's later. Okay. So I had to be honest with myself, with my addiction, and with a sponsor and other members of the fellowship. And I had to be open to different opinions and constructive criticism, a lot of constructive criticism. And different perspectives. I only thought like my life was a one-way street, and you know, I wasn't willing to hear anybody else out. And so that was a struggle for me to be, like I said, I don't like being told what to do. And so many people started telling me what to do, and I was like, you know, I just had to just do it. And then also I had to be open to turning my life and my will over to an invisible person that I've never met before, because they can handle it better than I can. And that's odd to me, but it works. Okay. Alcoholism is a disease of perception. And I actually just read about this the other day. So I'm still learning, obviously. But it's the disease of perception. So I actually not that long ago started questioning if I belonged in AA. Because I sit in here and think, you know, these people drank for 20, 30, 40 years. Like, they lost businesses, they lost homes. You know, I hear all these things, and that just didn't, like, it just didn't sound like my, you know, like my story. It didn't sound like me. And I had to tell my sponsor, my current sponsor, that I felt that way. And, you know, I had to tell on myself before my thinking spiraled. And I was picking out all the differences and just being negative. And my perception on the situation was that I'm not normally like a daily drinker. I don't wake up in the morning and think, oh my God, I need a drink right now. Or, oh my gosh, I need to go find drugs right now. I just have never been that through my whole addiction, and I'm not now. So I started just thinking down that direction, but my reality is, the different perception, my reality is that I binge drink, and I black out, and I hurt people with my words and my hands, and I set cars on fire, and I get DUIs, and I go to jail, and like, that's just in one night, you know? That's horrible. It's like a month's worth of like everybody else's drinking activities, and I just cram it into one night, you know? It's horrible. But I have sat in here for almost 2 years, and I've heard people say, oh my God, my story's in the back of the book. Oh, this story touched me. It's in the back of the book. And I thought, I'm never going to get a story in the back of the book, because my story just doesn't fit here. Right. But I found it the other day, and I was in a meeting, and I was so pumped. I was so pumped that I found it, and I shared it, and I was like, this is my story. This is so cool. And everyone's just kind of like, chill out. But like, I sat up that night thinking about it. I read it over and over. I went and told my parents, look at this, I'm in the book finally. And so this is what was read. It's out of They Stopped in Time. So it says, among today's incoming AA members may have never among today's incoming AA members, many have never reached the advanced stages of alcoholism, though given time, all might have. Most of these fortunate ones have had little or no acquaintance with delirium, hospitals, asylums, and jails. Some were drinking heavily, and there had been occasional serious episodes. But with many, drinking had been little more than a sometimes uncontrollable nuisance. They realized that repeated lack of drinking control when they had really wanted control was the fatal symptom that spelled problem drinking, right? Those are the people that aren't daily drinkers. Those are the people that drink once and they destroy themselves in one night, right? One go. And so that was my story. I'm still pumped about it. I'll go home and read it again later. So for anyone new or anyone that's like in the rooms just questioning, like, do you belong here? You know, the only, which my sponsor had to remind me of, the only requirement for AA membership is the desire to stop drinking. Well, I don't want to drink. I know where it takes me, you know. I am an alcoholic. No, alcoholism looks so different. And I didn't understand that because the family that I grew up with that drank, they drank a gallon of vodka with some, we're from Colorado, so some Coors Lights have to be in there. And then it's like all day until they get mean and then pass out at the end of the night. That's what I thought an alcoholic was. And I wasn't that, but I am an alcoholic. It says it in the book. If all you have to do is have a desire to stop drinking or your desire to get your life back, or to get your sanity back, or most of it in that case, I don't have my full sanity back. I don't know that I ever will, but it's getting there. You can get your job or your family back. Those are a lot of things that a lot of people lose. And then, just the desire to find other solutions that aren't drinking or using. My sponsor really gets on me for step 11, and he made sure to ask me 5 times this week if I was going to put step 11 in my speech. So here's step 11. And that's sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying for knowledge of his will and the power to carry it out. I struggle with this because, like I said, I'm mad at God all the time. I get mad at God all the time. I'm mad at him right now. But, you know, I grew up Christian. It was always there. But I never understood God, and I think that's why I was so mad at him, is I never understood him. I didn't understand why he took family members, you know, that I prayed really hard for them to live, and you know, they would pass. And in my childhood, I thought that was my fault. Like, if I forgot to pray for them, I'm like, oh my God, I killed my uncle or something, right? So I stopped praying. And I never understood why every time I prayed to God, because I prayed to God, please let me die. And he would leave me here. I still don't know why, but I guess that's none of my business. You know, it'll be my business when it needs to be my business. And I'm really nosy, so I want to understand God, and I want to know why the hell he does what he does. But it's just not my place, you know. It's not my place to understand God. And, you know, I don't need to know the logical definition of God to continue to improve my conscious contact. So we're working on praying. I actually just asked to pray for the first time the other day, like by myself. And it was just because, you know, I had this overwhelming feeling of like, I don't know what to do. And then I just called my sponsor and I said, can I pray? It was resentments, actually. And I don't like praying for people that bother me. So, you know, I'm working on these things. You know, that's the thing, is I'm still willing and I'm still open-minded. So I called the other day and I said, can you pray with me? And we prayed and I felt better. I went to sleep that night without feeling like hatred and stress, you know, and I slept fine and it was like great, you know. And I don't know why I wasn't doing this sooner, but then I get stubborn on it again, you know. I don't know. I'm a work in progress, but I'm willing to grow along spiritual lines. That's all that matters. So the first year of sobriety, I feel like, is about survival. Like, you're just trying to survive. And the second year is, like, when you start putting in work, you know. All those things that you were hearing that were kind of like, wah, 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 and, like, you hear them again, and you're like, oh, I have to do that. So being in my second year, some things that I'm still working on are actively doing a personal inventory. Every time I feel like there's something wrong in my life, I ask, what am I doing wrong? What am I doing wrong? And the steps help you figure that out. So I'm on my 6th round of steps. And I'm not saying that to be like, oh my God, I'm so cool, I'm doing steps. No, I'm insane and I need to figure out what's wrong with me, right? So I'm doing the steps. And another thing is I'm working on my emotional sobriety. Gaining control over my emotions. That's a hard one for me because I suppressed my emotions up until this point. So I wasn't allowed to cry. I cry almost every day, like every day. Sometimes it's for good reasons, and most of the time it's because like I'm having a panic attack or a meltdown. But you know, that's okay because I'm learning how to deal with those things. I have to learn how to cry. I have to learn how to express my emotions. And I'm good at crying now, I'll tell you that much. But I need to get better at like wrapping it up, you know, and getting it together. Thinking before speaking. That is my biggest downfall, is I do not think before I speak, which has gotten me really good at step 10, because then I have to apologize to people. And I've been really good at apologizing too. I almost look for reasons to apologize to people sometimes, you know, just because I'm like, look what I can do now. I can apologize to people. And also how to overcome feeling defeated, you know? Because that's the thing, I feel defeated and then I spiral in it, you know? And then I can't come out of that spiral and then it's too deep and then it's like, well, then I'm at the liquor store and then I'm at the dealer's house, you know? And then I'm in someone's random basement and I don't know where I'm at. And that's just where my defeat goes. So I'm working on how to overcome feeling defeated. I communicate that to numerous people when I'm feeling that way. You know, I like to talk about it. I also get outside help. I have a therapist, that poor lady, but, you know, we're getting there. So no matter how many times you fall, you know, how many times you feel defeated, if you fall 7, stand up 8. That's what this program is. You fall 7 times, you stand up 8. And there's a room full of people with their hands out ready to help you up. And there is a solution. This program is a permanent solution to a permanent problem. It's not a cure. It's a permanent solution to our permanent drinking problem as long as you keep coming back. You can't just come for a week and then you're good. That's your solution. You know, you have to keep coming back. You have to work. Oh, I don't do the thing at the end of it where it's like, it works if you work it. Oh, I think that's so cheesy. But it's true. It's true. It works if you work it. It's true. Things that I get to do today because of sobriety are, I'm almost done. Things that I get to do today are, I get to go back to school. I'm not going to go back to be a surgeon because I don't trust myself with a scalpel in my hands, but I am going to school to be a drug and alcohol counselor because it's something that I'm passionate about and it's something that I think I'm good at, or I'm getting good at, you know, sobriety. I get to be around my family. I'm invited to Christmases and Thanksgivings and graduations. I get to wake up in my own bed, and I'm not in jail, or, you know, hungover, or on a park bench, and I get to hear the birds. I used to hate birds, because when you stay up all night and you hear the birds chirping, you're like, fuck, like, I gotta go to work in an hour, and I'm drunk, you know? I wake up, and I'm like, oh my god, there's birds chirping. I'm like Snow White, you know? I love those things. And I get to help myself and I get to help others. That's my favorite part of this thing. I used to hate helping others. I don't like people, but I'm loving people now, you know? I mean, for the most part. So I love helping people, you know? Things that I am today. Who am I today? I'm honest. I'm kind. I'm happy. Not all the time. I'm not happy all the time, but I feel happiness now, and I'm happy to be alive. I'm trustworthy, I'm driven, and I'm motivated, and I'm sober. And that's the greatest gift I've ever received in my life, is sobriety. As hard as it is, you know, it's worth it. So, for, I guess, the newcomers, mostly, because you're the most important people in the room, don't give up before the miracle happens. You know, I almost gave up before that miracle happened, and God said, no, I don't want you up here right now. Go back down there and figure your shit out, you know? And I'm the one to judge what the miracle is. I think there's more than one miracles that come from this, for sure. But I know a lot of things have felt like a miracle since I've been here. So don't give up before the miracle happens. That's it. Lexi, that was wonderful. You did a great job. Really inspirational. Great wisdom. Thank you so much. Yeah.